From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When tar balls recently showed up in Lake Pontchartrain, it was a shock to local officials. They'd been told they weren't as vulnerable to the leaking oil as coastal areas closer to the Gulf. But St. Tammany Parish, on the north shore of the lake above New Orleans, now finds itself on the front line of the cleanup effort. NPR's Kathy Lohr visited a contingent on the lake that's getting creative in its fight against the spreading oil.
As we head out into Lake Pontchartrain from the Rigolese Marina, we pass a row of barges stacked up at the entrance to one pass, but the real action is farther out.
How you doing, sir?
All right.
Thank y'all for being aboard.
We're escorted onto a barge. It's a local experiment in skimming that works in deep and shallow water. Two fishing boats are out in front, trailing lines of bright orange boom behind them. That boom is funneled back to the barge in a sort of V shape.
This area here, this is where the oil would be captured.
Bobby Phillips is with K&K Construction and Disaster Services. We watch as half a dozen crewmen scan the water for signs of oil.
So the oil comes in, is funneled in with the boom, with the shrimp boats. It gets into this area. There's a pan underwater here that keeps it contained.
We're in the Rigolese, a narrow passage that runs between the Gulf and Lake Pontchartrain. It's sweltering as the intense sun reflects off the metal barge and off the water.
It's hot, it's muggy, you know.
Kente Walker from Picayune, Mississippi, used to work on boats that supplied oil rigs in the Gulf, but he was laid off. Now he and three others hold fishing nets on long poles and gaze into the water for hours and hours.
For the last 3-4 days, tar balls has floated up, some size of a baseball, some size of a half a dollar, and some size of a silver dime. And I use this net, and we just, as we see them coming, we just pick them up.
But on this day, the crew didn't find any oil. This is one of several defenses St. Tammany Parish is using to try to stop any more oil from entering this beloved lake. Traditional skimmers also scan the water. We leave the barge and head to an area where crews have just installed a new kind of very expensive permeable boom. It's supposed to be more stable and collect the oil while letting water pass through. The cost to BP, some $800,000 for just 9,000 feet.
To say that any oil's come in is obviously disappointing because you don't want to see any.
Thomas Beal works for St. Tammany Parish. He says tar balls recently found here were disturbing and a warning. If a storm in the Gulf kicks up the currents and the wind blows the right way, it's going to be more difficult to stop the oil.
I mean, we don't have a choice. We need to do this. It's far too important, both ecologically, economically, and to the general way of life of Southeast Louisiana, not to.
Back at the Rigolese Marina, Parish President Ken Davis says waging this battle is expensive. It costs $16,000 a day in this parish alone. They got a $500,000 grant from BP, but that hasn't covered all the expenses yet. Davis says he's also worried about the long term.
What are we going to do about employment issues, certain sections of our economy?
Hundreds of commercial fishermen can't work. Tourism is off too. But Davis says business is down even in unrelated industries, like car dealerships, because, he says, people are just waiting.
So what it tells us is people are frightened. They don't know about tomorrow. So what they typically do then is not spend money, which then creates a whole nother economy issue.
Davis says he and other leaders here have more ideas for attacking the spill, among them the use of experimental bioremediation technology, where microbes are put into the water to eat the oil. He says he has written many letters to BP, but there are no quick decisions. Davis says as many great ideas as local governments have, they can't pursue them because they can't enter into million-dollar contracts the way BP and the government can. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, New Orleans.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Arthur Levine has spent much of his career writing about how tough it is for poor minority kids to get into college. But rarely has this respected educator and former president of Teachers College at Columbia University written more urgently than in his latest book titled Unequal Fortunes. Levine journeyed back to his childhood in the South Bronx to understand why he made it and why most kids living there now don't. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has this profile.
Tonight at El Jobo, a popular Dominican restaurant on 181st Street, there's good reason to celebrate.
One, two, three. Cumpleaños feliz. Te deseamos a ti. Cumpleaños, dear Arthur.
Arthur Levine just turned 62 years old. The book that he and Laura Scheiber, a former student, started 10 years ago, was just released. And two of the 14-year-olds they wrote about, Carlos and Juan Carlos, have joined them for dinner and cake. They hug, they laugh, they reminisce, and later, in a park down the street, they ponder the book's central question. Is the American dream a myth, an empty promise? What do you think, Levine asks Juan Carlos, now 24.
I don't really think that it exists anymore. It's just that, it's a dream. It's a dream.
Aren't you guys the products of the American dream at some level? You grew up in families in which your parents didn't have a lot of education. You guys are college graduates.
Yeah, but we're also the exceptions.
Right. But for you two, it existed.
Well, what does the American dream mean to you?
It pretty much means that you could be born anywhere from the bottom and you still have a chance of making it to the top. But to say that our system itself has set up an American dream that works, I think that's false.
I believe in the American dream. Definitely, yes. Sir.
That's Carlos, always the optimist. Hard to say how their friend Leo would have responded. He's the other 14-year-old in the book who can't be here tonight. Leo was shot and killed by a New York City policeman during a confrontation 5 years ago. He would have just turned 24.
There's nothing good about this story at all. But his story lives. You know? So it's sort of like he never dies.
Earlier in the day, Levine had taken me to Leo's sidewalk memorial, a few blocks away.
There's a... At the center of the mural is a picture of Leo. And he's wearing a baseball cap with the seal of the Dominican Republic on it. He has long braids. He's wearing a chain.
In front of the 12-foot-high mural sits a small wooden box. Inside, a few dried-up flowers and several veladoras, tall candles, burned down to a nub. What happened to Leo, says Levine, happens to lots of children growing up in the South Bronx.
Kids in this neighborhood don't go to college. Kids in this neighborhood do drop out. Kids in this neighborhood do end up without jobs. Kids in this neighborhood end up without futures. And in Leo's case, he ended up dying at 19.
Did Leo have a shot at making it out of this neighborhood, I asked Levine.
Once he moved into this neighborhood, the answer was no.
For a true believer in the power of education and upward mobility, it's a stunning confession that Levine wants to explain to be fair to Leo.
Leo understood that education was important. In his diary, he wrote this passage that I will never forget. It said, I know that if I go to college, I'll get the house in the country. I can help my parents. I can marry a girl I respect who graduated from high school. Next paragraph. I haven't been to school in 3 weeks. I went to school today, but I didn't go to any classes. I had sex under the stairs.
You see, says Levine, Leo faced some pretty tough odds from the day he arrived in New York at age 8 with his mother from the Dominican Republic. He was bright, but he struggled with English. He was ambitious, but attended overcrowded, dysfunctional, violent schools. He desperately wanted to please those he loved, especially his mother. But to avoid getting jumped every day, Leo joined a gang. In the end, he ignored his mother's advice, and the streets swallowed Leo whole.
You can't be on top of me. That's not happening.
How you doing?
No, another one.
On the corner of 181st and Creston Avenue, young mothers pushed their strollers towards PS 79, Leo's elementary school. The same school Levine attended 56 years ago, back when the neighborhood was almost entirely white, and the language of the streets was English, and sometimes Yiddish.
What changed about the neighborhood was, when I lived here, there was more of a mix of income levels. So the teacher lived in the neighborhood. There was a dentist who lived in the neighborhood. There was a doctor down the block. And you saw brothers and sisters who were older than you, neighbors, heading off to college. These were kids who were going to have a future better than their parents, which is real different than what goes on today.
Today, the language of the streets is Spanish, and the people who live here are poor, more isolated than we ever were, says Levine.
The story of the South Bronx is the story of a working-class neighborhood that became poor. And with that change, the American dream died.
Levine grows quiet as we walk up Preston Avenue. A block away, the elevated subway train runs right down the middle of Jerome Avenue. Below, the steel girders, a string of bodegas line the sidewalks where a kosher deli and two Jewish-owned bakeries once thrived. In his youth, says Levine, this community was a nurturing, hopeful place that his parents saw as a stepping stone to a better life.
They were moving away from the ghettos of the South Bronx.
Show me where you lived.
I lived in the building right ahead of us, 2078 Preston Avenue, and the last window over to the left on the ground floor was my bedroom. When I first came here, Carlos lived there.
Carlos, his friends, and Juan Carlos and Leo, of course, became the central characters in Levine's book. They kept brutally honest diaries, and those diaries gave voice to all that Levine wanted to denounce.
My hope is that this book shows this community is isolated, not by choice, but by circumstance. And I hope that it shows that the community is a dangerous one to live in. It's hard to blame them for conditions like that.
Unlike so many of Levine's books, Unequal Fortunes is not just about failed institutions and policies. It's more of a plea for readers to peer into poor children's harrowing lives and become advocates for what Levine calls a Schindler's List kind of change. Maybe not to save all children, but to rescue as many as possible. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Corey Turner, and produced by Neil Carruth. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson. Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes.
The staff includes Graham Smith, Julia Buckley, Theo Balcom, Bilal Qureshi, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Chelsea Jones, Viet Le, and Rhonda Ray. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From that All-Star game to the World Cup to Wimbledon and the saga of LeBron James, sports fans have a right to be exhausted. Commentator Frank DeFord is certainly feeling fatigued.
Now that those awful soccer horns have finally stopped blowing, could we please maybe all quiet down and perhaps just have some nice, subdued games? Good grief, has sports ever endured such a summer of excess? Everything has been overdone, overlong, overemphasized, over the top. And, of course, most of it has been foisted on us relentlessly by the television network of which sports is now a wholly owned subsidiary, ESPN, or more accurately, XSPN. It was XSPN, of course, which brought us, above all, the tackiest display of televised exploitation since Geraldo Rivera opened up Al Capone's secret vault to reveal nothing. As LeBron James said so modestly, "I'm taking my talents and going," has any immodest body, politician, actor, artist, who specialize in the excess business, ever announced their departure by describing their leave-taking as a vast talent resettlement. And LeBron, don't forget to take your ego, too. The Cleveland owner, Dan Gilbert, didn't help the situation by making some intemperate comments about James's departure. He was crying out as a Clevelander scorned, speaking emotionally for a city that has suffered literally generations without championship. Yes, his criticisms were beyond the pale. But what Gilbert made unnecessarily personal was not enough for the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who saw a way to stumble back into the headlines by wrenching racism into the cauldron, saying that the Cleveland owner viewed James as a runaway slave. Please, talk about excess and runaway rhetoric. Wimbledon's only highlight was that dreadful 70-68 set. Look, yes, the two players get credit for surviving, and we got to vicariously enjoy a freak show on XSPN. But what such an endless exhibition really tells us is that games today last excessively long and must have a tiebreaker to end it. 70-68 is not natural. It is Botox tennis. Finally, for simple, disgusting, all-around, all-American excess, we retreated to the annual hot dog-eating contest at Coney Island, televised, of course, on XSPN. Some people miss the point. They ask, is stuffing wieners in your mouth a sport? Rather, the question is watching other people stuff wieners in their mouth a sign that we are just tired of too much real sport? Do you get the feeling sometimes that we all live our lives in a sports bar?
Frank DeFord's new novel is Bliss Remembered. That is a romantic suspense story set against the backdrop of the 1936 Berlin Olympics. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And Steve Inskeep's still away. He's working on his book all this month. Sitting in for him and delighted to be here, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
If you just look at the numbers, the economy is in the midst of a recovery. Yet millions of jobless Americans still aren't feeling the uptick. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is holding a summit today to talk about creating more jobs. The chamber has been critical of Obama administration policies, saying they hurt business. NPR's Tamara Keith tracked down a couple of small business owners to ask them why they aren't hiring.
Ask John Brinson why he isn't adding employees, and the answer is surprisingly simple.
We don't need new employees.
And why doesn't he need them?
You don't hire people just to hire people. You know, you hire them because you need them. And we don't need them because business is not good enough.
Brinson is in the fitness business. He owns four clubs in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley. 2 years ago, Brinson's business was booming. Then Lehman Brothers failed, the entire financial system teetered on collapse, and the trouble reached all the way to Allentown, Pennsylvania.
The bottom fell out. People got scared.
And some canceled their memberships. Brinson's business is down 20%. But instead of letting employees go, he got them all to agree to a 10% pay cut. He'd like to restore their wages. And he says he'll do that before adding new positions.
What we're selling, which is fitness, most people do not consider essential. Other things come first. So they're not going to buy from us until the economy gets better. So we're just hanging on and hoping it's going to get better.
A recent survey from the National Federation of Independent Business backs this up. According to the trade group, owners of small businesses say weak sales are their biggest problem. Few have any plans to hire in coming months. And that's not a good sign for the recovery, since these small businesses create the majority of new jobs. Brooke Rush is coated in a mix of sweat and sawdust. He owns a construction company in southeastern Pennsylvania that specializes in custom homes and remodels. This job is a big one, replacing a roof, but he hasn't built a custom home in 3 years. In better times, he'd have four or five guys working for him. Now he has just two.
The work just wasn't there, and I didn't see it coming. The calls had dropped off, so the phones weren't ringing. Sometimes we just call ourselves just to make sure the phones are still working.
Rush has been in this business for 32 years, so he's been through recessions before.
This is different. I've never seen people so reluctant to spend money. My customers, they're like the stock market. They don't like uncertainty.
And as far as Rush is concerned, uncertainty is at an all-time high.
The real issue is just the psychology of it's just being uncertain. We live in very uncertain times. I mean, there's all this stuff going on in Washington. It's just, and people don't know what's going to happen.
His list of concerns includes health care reform and the Bush-era tax breaks that are set to expire later this year.
I worry tremendously about that.
Rush says it doesn't look like he'll have enough work to bring on another employee anytime soon. Maybe in a year or two. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Our last word in business today is happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.
Hundreds of items of memorabilia from the last of the Singing Cowboys go on the block today.
The Roy Rogers Show, starring Roy Rogers, King of the Cowboys, and Dale Evans, Queen of the West.
Roy Rogers starred in more than 100 movies and a long-running TV show. His cowboy hats, boots, guitars, even a 1964 convertible with six shooters for door handles are all up for sale today at Christie's. Rogers' family is selling off the items in order to pay off debts. Kathy Elkies is with the auction house, and she says the highlight is likely to be Rogers' faithful horse. That would be Trigger, of course, which has been preserved.
You think of Roy, you think of Trigger. They really go hand in hand. When Trigger died, Roy really was so incredibly bereft that he didn't want to bury Trigger, so he ended up taxidermying him. So he is actually mounted in the galleries in his sort of famous rearing position.
And Elke says the horse could corral up to $200,000. If that's too pricey, there's also Roger's stuffed and mounted wonder dog, Bullet. He's expected to fetch about $10,000.
And bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Starting this week, it will be easier for veterans to receive help for post-traumatic stress disorder. President Obama introduced new rules that should streamline the claim process. Ron Capps is a former soldier who retired after serving 25 years in Kosovo, Rwanda, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Sudan. He describes how PTSD made him feel desperate.
When the phone rang, I jumped a little, startled, and nearly shot myself. This would have been ironic since I was holding the pistol in my hand, planning to kill myself, but I would have pulled the trigger while it was pointed at my foot rather than my head. That was in 2005. I was a soldier on active duty. I spent more than 20 years working in places like Kosovo, Rwanda, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Darfur. I've seen some bad stuff, and somewhere along the way, my brain stopped working right. I have post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. I remember lying on my cot in my tent in Afghanistan, bundled into my sleeping bag, terrified because the dead had come to talk with me. They came every night, wresting me away from a warm, comforting sleep into a series of wretched, tormenting, wide-awake dreams. On one night, it would be a farmer and his wife, burned Bible black and twisted into hideous shapes, who asked, "Do you remember us?" "Oh, most certainly." On another, 42 men all shot in the back or in the head and left to die in a rocky ditch on a frozen January morning. "Why didn't you do more to save us?" they asked. "Why indeed?" The images terrified me, mostly because I couldn't stop them from taking control of my mind. I knew I needed help, but I didn't ask for it because I thought I would be ridiculed, considered weak and cowardly. In Army culture, especially in the elite unit filled with Rangers and paratroopers in which I served, asking for help was showing weakness. My two Bronze Stars, my tours in airborne and special operations units, none of these would matter. To ask for help would be seen as breaking. But finally, when, in the middle of the day, I was forced to hide, shaking and crying in a concrete bunker, railing against the noise and the images in my head, and when I finally understood that to continue to deny this was to endanger the lives of the soldiers I was sent to Afghanistan to lead, I asked for help. Today, right now, we need to get more soldiers to ask for help. Reducing the stigma attached to mental health issues is the first step. When soldiers see their peers ridiculed or accused of malingering or of cowardice, they won't seek the help they need. Maybe that's why, in the first half of 2009, more American soldiers committed suicide than died in combat. These aren't our first wars. We know what happens to people's minds when they are confronted with these horrors. Personally, I'm lucky. I'm alive today because I didn't pull the trigger that day in Darfur. But thousands of other soldiers and veterans have made different choices.
Ron Capps' full essay appears in the Narrative Matters section of the July issue of the journal Health Affairs.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.